Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Happy Tuesday morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on 91.5 KJZZ in Phoenix. With Lauren Gilger, I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up this hour, visiting a new facility meant to house migrants in Yuma, and we'll relive a golden age of Valley music with the Pistoleros.
But first, the Mesa City Council approved last night a $1 billion development plan to bring a Google data center to the city. If Google moves forward with the deal, the facility will occupy the northwest corner of Elliott and Sussman Roads and span 187 acres. But according to the Arizona Republic, the deal includes a property tax break of $16 million over the next 25 years. And the city of Mesa expects the data center to contribute about $61 million to the city via taxes in that time. So what will this data center look like, and what will it mean for the region's growing tech sector? For more on that, I caught up with Mike Hutchinson, Executive Vice President of the East Valley Partnership, earlier this morning.
Well, it's a huge development for the state, frankly. Google is going to buy 190 acres and start building a major data center, which will start with 250,000 square feet, but would grow to 750,000 square feet. So it's a huge win for Mesa and for the region and for the state in terms of having this great company in our midst.
What would the economic impact estimates be at this point?
Well, they're still preliminary. They're working on what the job counts will be. And data centers don't have thousands of jobs, but they have very important jobs. So both the long-term impact of the job growth there plus the construction impact as this thing is built out over time, they're talking about $1 billion worth of construction. That's a B. So it's a huge deal. And there'll be, jobs and for construction people, for suppliers, for years to come.
Data centers, like you said, not going to employ a ton of people. What exactly is the role of the data center? It's almost like the power source.
Yeah, it's the power source for Google as they continue to grow and develop. They need additional data centers. So Apple has a data center in the same tech corridor in Mesa, and there's others planned on the books. So the providers have found a great spot, and we're pleased as a region that they found this location.
So is there something about this area that kind of attracted companies like this? Like, what was the motivation?
Well, I think the city of Mesa over many years has done some great planning in terms of infrastructure, streets and water and other needed fiber connections. So they've been talking about this area as a tech corridor for years. And so that all that planning and that investment, which is, the city's made a huge investment in terms of, as I said, infrastructure, is paying off now. And, I think this region, Mesa, the East Valley, the Phoenix metropolitan area is seen by folks as a good place to be in terms of all the other amenities that come with having a business here.
I want to ask you a question, though, about the way in which the city council has approved this. So it was a giblet deal. It will give millions in tax breaks to Google. And, these are pretty controversial. Some call them corporate welfare. Why go about it in this way?
Well, in economic development and recruitment, the East Valley, the region, the state is in competition with other parts of the country, Texas and Colorado and Utah. And there's incentives offered in all these states. There's not, I don't think, a state that doesn't have. So this is a tool that's been authorized to be used in the state. Mesa and other cities are cautious on the use, but there comes a time where to be able to attract someone with this name and this capacity and the future growth, they have to occasionally use giblets. So I've looked at some of the information. There's going to be some tax breaks, but the tax gain for all the entities as this property goes into this use is dramatic. Right now it's agricultural with very limited returns. Over time it'll be a really positive property tax gain for schools and the city and the county and other entities.
Mm-hmm. So looking at this broader picture and this idea of creating a tech corridor in that part of the valley and creating a broader tech presence in the East Valley in general, which I know your organization focuses a lot on, what does this do for that? Like, how does this move you forward?
Well, it's an unbelievable time in the East Valley and in the region in terms of economic development. So this just is another important development area. There's others in the region in Chandler or the Intel, the Price Road Corridor is really growing again in terms of high tech. And there's other parts of the valley. Tempe was the ASU developments in that growth. So it just helps us as we go out and try to attract businesses here that bring the jobs that we want our residents to have over time. And they'll be good paying jobs and folks will be able to build houses and live in a great quality of life.
All right. Mike Hutchinson is the Executive Vice President of the East Valley Partnership. Mike, thank you for coming on.
Sure. Thank you.
The state of Arizona may withhold up to $1 million in economic development funding from a proposed Nike factory plan for Goodyear. Governor Ducey announced via Twitter earlier this morning he was pulling funds in response to Nike canceling a new sneaker with a Betsy Ross-themed flag on the back of the shoe. That announcement came hours after the city of Goodyear approved financial incentives for Nike to build the $184 million facility. Here to help us make sense of this is Howie Fisher with Capital Media Services. Howie, I have to admit, I'm not really sure you make sense of anything, but thanks for being with us anyway.
Well, I'm not sure if you can really make sense of this. I think there are a lot of people who reacted very quickly and without counting to 10, both in terms of Nike and the governor.
Well, Lauren and I were discussing this. Is Governor Ducey turning into President Trump at this point? Are we surprised that he would send out early morning tweets like this?
Well, it's always interesting when you got to wonder, what was he doing up at 2 in the morning, reading his Wall Street Journal and deciding to react? And did he actually talk to anybody from his staff? It's real easy to react to something and saying, well, wait, this Betsy Ross flag, for the listeners who don't know, this is the 13 stars in a circle on a field of blue plus the red and white stripes. It was an early version of the flag. It's certainly a historic flag. Part of what's happened is it's been sort of appropriated by some racist and right-wing groups, much in the same way that the Gadsden flag, that famous Don't Tread on Me flag, has been sort of appropriated by the Tea Party. So the question is, Nike made a business decision after talking to Colin Kaepernick, and said, well, we're not going to put it out. Well, then the governor made his quick decision saying, well, we don't have to suck up, his words, mm-hmm. to this company over its decisions. Seems like a lot of people were reacting to a lot of stuff in the middle of the night.
So that's the question I have then. What kinds of reactions are we hearing from folks from the city of Goodyear, from people on both sides of the aisle? This is stirring up quite a bit of controversy, it sounds like.
Well, I think the Goodyear folks are still trying to absorb what was going on. I mean, they, as you pointed out, had just voted last night to provide some incentives. They see this as 500 and some good jobs. I mean, in order to get reimbursed, the average base salary has to be in the $48,000 range. You know, you also have to remember, this is a governor who holds press conferences and has held press conferences over the last 5 years of somebody bringing 100 to 200 jobs to Arizona. So for whatever reason, and again, trying to get inside the governor's head is really difficult. He's decided that he's going to make this political statement here to say, well, we don't necessarily need Nike. And to the 500 people who would otherwise be working at this plant, we don't necessarily need those jobs.
Well, Howie, I'm going to ask you to read the governor's mind to some extent. I bet you've covered him extensively for quite a long time. The fact that he would say we're not going to suck up to certain companies, even though, as you mentioned, there are press conferences for jobs that are expected to not bring, companies not expected to bring as many jobs. So is there some sort of political calculation to this in any sense? I mean, obviously it is, but to what end?
Well, we've all been speculating as what Doug Ducey wants to do after his term of office is up. He's going to be 58 years old. I don't know that he's ready to retire. Is he looking for a job perhaps in what he thinks will be the next Trump administration? What is he trying to do? What credentials is he trying to burnish for himself? Because this is normally a very careful governor, very weighs his words. Fact is, sometimes trying to get an actual statement out of him is like pulling teeth. Mm. You know, we get this sort of canned response. Press 1 for my views on school finance. Press 2 for my views on economic development. So for him to do that, somewhere in his mind, there was a calculation made, I need to say something here. Now, again, the question is, you know, was this well thought out by Nike? Was this well thought out by Ducey? And at what point do we decide that otherwise historical items like this flag, otherwise historical items like this flag should, if they get appropriated by someone else, you know, do we suddenly decide that they're racist? Now, that was Nike's decision.
Right.
Then obviously the governor reacted. And again, I think a lot of people, maybe they need to be sleeping in the middle of the night rather than making these decisions.
All right. Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks as always, and have a happy 4th.
You too.
Arizona Public Schools will not receive any new money for police officers on campus, counselors, and social workers in August. This is despite $20 million in new dollars in funding for school safety in Arizona's budget. So from KJZZ's education desk, Mariana Dale is here to explain why. Good morning, Mariana.
Morning.
Okay, so we know Arizona has a grant program that pays for police officers on school campuses, but that program has a wait list because there hasn't been enough funding in the past. How could this money have helped them?
Well, Department of Education staff proposed giving $8.9 million to those 87 waitlisted schools so they could actually hire those police officers that they had wanted to hire last year. The rest of that $20 million would have paid for every single school in the program to also hire a counselor or a social worker. In all, that's more than 200 schools that would have gotten new counselors, social workers, police officers, or some combination of the three.
Okay, so why didn't that happen?
Well, there was a concern that the board was really rushing spending this money. So they voted to fund the original program as it was, schools that were already getting the money or planning to get the money, still getting that money. And this is how board member Michelle Kay explained it at the meeting.
The funds are there, but because they're there doesn't mean we need to expend them so quickly without a solid process.
And I'm going to try not to get too technical or boring, but essentially the school safety program is in the middle of a 3-year cycle right now. So it's a really big lift to create a totally new program to spend this money in just a few months. This proposal to spend it on those waitlisted schools was a workaround. Superintendent Kathy Hoffman was actually the only one that supported this workaround, though. She said it was because of the urgency she's seen in schools to address this issue.
While I completely respect the idea that we want to have a process and due diligence, it also makes me really anxious to sit on $23 million that could be put towards school safety in the meantime.
Okay, so I understand you took a field trip to learn more about how this is going to affect schools not using this money. What did you hear?
Yeah, so on Monday, I sat down with Wilson Elementary School Principal Cindy Campton.
We have about 650 students, and we're located on 29th Street in Fillmore. So right in the heart of Phoenix.
Wilson Elementary is also one of those schools that was on that wait list we talked about, and they won't be seeing a school resource officer next year.
And to find out that the money is now there and is going to sit there for at least half the year, it's just, I don't get it. I don't understand it.
Campton even tried to pay for a school resource officer through crowdfunding last year,
wow.
But they couldn't raise enough money. And before that, they had a cop on campus for almost 20 years. So she's really familiar with what a difference having a school resource officer can make.
One of the misconceptions out there with having SROs on campus is that they're here to arrest kids. It's actually the exact opposite. SROs are here to educate kids, and they're very proactive.
How have things changed on the Wilson Elementary School campus in the last year?
The principal says they've had to call police more frequently since they no longer just have an officer on campus already. These aren't necessarily all arrests, but it's things like marijuana and alcohol on school campus, trespassing, and then there's also some mandatory reporting they have to do, like for child abuse. Mm-hmm. School staff, students, and parents are often waiting hours for police to arrive, and that's because the police there are pretty busy. The area where the school is located is known for having the most concentrated number of homicides in the county.
Hmm. Okay, so what happens now? When will Wilson Elementary and every other school that needs the money for a school resource officer, for that matter, counselor or social worker, when will they have a chance to get one?
We'll see. The Board of Ed meets again on August 26th, and staff at the Department of Ed have been told to use all possible resources to create that new application. Governor Doug Ducey's office sent me a statement saying they really want this done as soon as possible.
All right. That's KJZZ's Mariana Dale. Mariana, thank you for your reporting on this.
You're welcome.
An ongoing migration of asylum seekers from Central America has strained federal border agencies, nonprofit organizations, and local towns. Along Arizona's border with Mexico, the Trump administration is making room for even more migrants, but it's also increasing pressure on a neighboring Mexico border city. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk, Michelle Marisco reports from the border on two projects that will change how asylum seekers will arrive at the Arizona border.
First, the Border Patrol spent $15 million to turn a parking lot on its vast Yuma sector headquarters into a gleaming white tent compound. As temperatures top 110 degrees, massive air conditioners loudly blast 60-degree air through the tents to cool them as the agency awaits the first group of migrants.
Depending on the amount of people that are in here, right? So it's going to depend on how hard the system's going to work, because this is all drawn from generators.
Agency spokesman Desi De Leon shows the compound's breakdown. There are tents for sleeping, new cots stacked against a wall, where migrants will be checked for immigration backgrounds and fed.
The cold meal is a turkey sandwich, chips, and fruit, and either some kind of juice. So
they'll also receive two hot meals a day and snacks. Outside, workers use a forklift to maneuver a washing machine into another tent.
We're washing their clothes and providing them something that's available to all of us that we would like to have as human beings, really. So.
The facility is designed to hold 500 people, families, and lone children, and people will stay for up to 3 days. Apprehension slowed some in June, but Yuma continues to be the third busiest sector along the southwest border. This new facility went up as the Border Patrol was slammed by allegations that it mistreated children at its Clint, Texas facility. Then the U.S. government expanded its policy of making asylum seekers wait out their claims across from Yuma in Mexico. It's a policy deemed unsafe for people as violence hopscotches along Mexico's border cities. Some worry Central Americans will be targeted while they wait. Customs and Border Protection has been criticized for bottlenecking asylum seekers at the border already, a process called metering. Border Patrol Sector Chief Anthony Provaznik says CBP had no choice.
I think the ports of entry have to do some metering because they do have their job that they have to, they're responsible for legitimate trade and travel, and they only have so many people to do that job, and so they can only process so many people that are coming in to claim asylum or credible fear.
Across the border in San Luis Rio Colorado, Martin Salgado plucks an old blue book sitting askew on a shelf and held together with scotch tape, where he and his staff at the Casa de Migrantes painstakingly note the names of new arrivals trying to head north. It's the only official record either country has of who is trying to ask for asylum here. The people in it are predominantly from Mexico, but they're also from
Venezuela, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Colombia, Haiti, Azerbaijan, Senegal, Salvador, Turquía, Ucrania, Cameroon.
His shelter was intended for deportees to stay for a short while, not for asylum seekers expecting to wait for months.
Pues primero Dios, Estados Unidos.
Irles Vega says she hopes to God to arrive to the U.S., but she and her son have already waited in Mexico 2 months just to ask for asylum, the result of that metering. And they may return here under the so-called migrant protection protocols to wait even longer. Salgado worries temperatures are rising in the desert and there's no room left here.
No hay la infraestructura ni en Yuma ni en San Luis para atender esos flujos que se pretenden.
Neither Yuma nor its neighboring Mexican town can handle a bigger bottleneck. Homeland Security beefed up infrastructure in Arizona, but the health concerns it sought to avoid in the U.S. now fall on Salgado and the city to manage. Reporting from San Luis Rio Colorado, Mexico, I'm Michel Marisco, KJZZ News.
The Remain in Mexico program started just this past weekend in San Luis, and we'll be keeping you updated on the situation there as asylum seekers gather at the border town. And here to discuss more details from our Fronteras desk in Tucson is KJZZ's Michel Marisco. Michel, good morning.
Good morning.
So the Border Patrol is going to take care of about 500 people, but what happens when the numbers inevitably go over that?
Right. So there's a 3-day limit for unaccompanied minors, for families to be able to stay there. And then they have to let them go. At that point, the NGOs in the area, and there's one, will need to step in and start the whole process of, you know, shipping people up to Phoenix.
Okay. So just like in neighboring cities in Mexico, we've already heard in the past from the Yuma mayor, that's news that in all these communities nearby cannot be well received, right?
Right. And here's Yuma Mayor Doug Nichols, who I just interviewed about this.
Really, these are federal issues, and the federal agencies on both sides need to be stepping up to help. I think it's inappropriate to expect local border communities to shoulder the burden of a national or even an international issue.
What they're stressing both in Arizona and in Mexico is that they're overwhelmed. Again, there's one NGO in the area, the Salvation Army, that can step in. Mexico, they have the Casa de Migrantes from the story. That's about it. You know, there are no resources. So if there's going to be, you know, several thousand asylum seekers being forced to wait in Mexico, there's literally nowhere for them to wait.
And a major question, the word is safety, question of safety in Mexico. You've reported that a major criticism of the Trump administration's so-called Remain in Mexico plan is you're going to put more migrants in danger. So has that happened here?
It has not happened here. Two incidences that really speak towards the dangers happened in three border towns in June alone. One in Agua Prieta in southeastern Arizona region, neighboring Naco, and then San Luis, this city. There were a total of 13 people who were killed. This is when Governor Ducey was worried enough that he asked DPS to increase patrols in these regions. The Border Patrol was doing the same thing. So was the Cochise County Sheriff. It was worrisome enough to American officials that there would be some sort of spillover. And there was a significant number of people dead over the course of a few days in those three towns. That's the sort of environment that asylum seekers are required to wait in right now.
And there is so much more to come. And when it happens, we will turn to KJZZ's Michel Marisco from the Fronteras desk in Tucson. Michel, thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Among the bills Governor Ducey signed into law last month is one that's going to require medical marijuana to be tested for contaminants. Those include pesticides and herbicides, heavy metals, even microbial contamination. Not following the law could lead dispensaries to face fines of up to $1,000 per violation. How could that affect patients, and could it lead to price increases for medical marijuana? In a moment, I'll talk with a journalist who has closely covered Arizona's marijuana industry. I start with Paul Seaborn, assistant professor at the University of Denver's Business School. He has studied what Colorado has done with its program. And, Professor, how important a premise is making sure that the marijuana does not contain herbicides and pesticides, for example?
I think it's a pretty important premise for two reasons. One, as we all know, this industry as a legal business is still relatively new. So I think there's still a lot to be learned and a lot of uncertainty about these products. And then secondly, because it's still considered federally illegal, you don't have the typical FDA or USDA oversight that would allow all states to benefit from some sort of federal program.
Is there a way, even a percentage increase in terms of the cost to growers and farmers when it comes to adding in the testing component?
Like everything else in the cannabis industry, these things tend to vary state by state. But here in Colorado, I know a typical test for one batch is going to be costing a producer around $100, maybe $120. And if you are a larger scale producer sending a number of different products and strains to these labs, you know, you might be spending a couple thousand or more dollars per week. So it's not an insignificant cost.
And that would be passed down to the consumers?
Potentially, yeah. I think certainly in our market in Colorado and some of the other more mature markets, it's very competitive at the end customer level. And so in some cases, it may be passed on. In some cases, this may become an extra cost that the producers are going to have to cover themselves.
And without speaking for every producer, one would think this is part of the cost of doing business because they would rather have people enjoy their product and be able to use it safely than worry about whether there are problems down the road.
Yes, I think for most of the stakeholders here, this is a win-win situation. Companies that think they're doing things the proper way or want to confirm that they're doing things the proper way get that ability through testing, and certainly customers are much more informed and can be more confident in what they're receiving, and that makes regulators happy as well. I think the only catch can be, you know, those folks who maybe hadn't really figured out some of these key issues around microbials or homogeneity, making the product consistent. And so, you know, they may get a bit of a surprise, but I think that's probably par for the course.
That consistency is a really great word when it comes to this, because I really don't know when it comes down to, you know, we often hear the comparison between marijuana and different forms of alcohol, and people talk about how because alcohol has been legal for so long, then we're able to make a more pure batch and make it more consistent. Is that sort of a work in progress when it comes to marijuana and medical marijuana?
Yes, absolutely. So over the years that we've had testing in Colorado, I think what we've heard is that the testers themselves have learned a lot about how to test in a very accurate, precise way so that their results are true. And then I think on the other side, producers have also learned a lot about how to produce products, particularly as you go from just the flower, which is coming, you know, straight as an agricultural product, and then transforming that flower into some sort of a concentrate or a butter that's then used in some sort of an edible product. There's a number of steps in that process where you might not end up with a really consistent homogeneous product, but testing has been a great way for everyone involved to try to figure those things out.
Have you noticed that more of these kinks are getting worked out in a way that it's being approached like almost any other business?
Yeah, that's certainly been the case. So if you looked at Colorado's testing, initially it was focused on potency, how strong is the product, and this concept of homogeneity, how consistent is it if you take, you know, one corner of the edible product versus another. They added in all sorts of tests around microbials and, you know, residues from solvents. And now most recently, we're just moving into heavy metals. So there's been a real progression on what can be tested. But I think on the other side, there's also just been a improvement in terms of the consistency of what's coming out. But in the end, you know, the raw ingredient here is an agricultural product. And even which leaf or which part of that product you start with is going to affect all those other things down the line. So there's still some degree of uncertainty here, no matter what you do.
And did it take a while for testing companies to get a real foothold there?
It did. And I think that's a key challenge in all these states is you want to set up a program that works for the consumers and the producers of products, but it also has to work for those testing companies. If they don't see it as a viable business, or if for some reason the way the regulations are set up doesn't make it feasible for them, then you're sort of left in a vacuum. So it's very important right now at the state level to make sure that you create a program that works as a business for testing companies. And maybe someday we'll get to a place where you could have a testing company serving multiple states, but we're a long way from that because of the federal status.
Do you feel like this is an industry that is in just the early stages of having a real explosion, or do you think it's going to hit some limit at some point, some wall?
So it's a great question, and I think you'll get a number of answers from whoever you talk to, but my sense would be that we haven't seen a real step backwards in any states that have moved towards legalization, and so we continue to generally move in one direction towards more and more legal access. So I think the federal piece is certainly a tough one, and it may be that some changes in the banking or the taxing treatment of the industry come first, and then, you know, more widespread legalization takes a little bit longer. But every time you see a new state approve either a medical program or a recreational program, that movement continues to go primarily in one direction.
That is Paul Seaborn, assistant professor at the University of Denver's Business School. Along with the law requiring medical marijuana in Arizona to be tested for contaminants, the governor also signed legislation that would extend the life of a medical marijuana card from 1 to 2 years. Ray Stern of Phoenix New Times is with me to talk about that and the industry in Arizona more generally. Ray, how big a difference could this card change make?
The biggest significance of it is the cost, for sure. This is going to be maybe dramatic for a lot of people, and it could cause more people to sign up with the program. The costs are basically dropping in half. They're not actually dropping in half. That's just the effect, basically. So you're still going to have to shell out $150 when you go down to get a medical marijuana card. And then there'll be a cost for the doctor at visit. And that could be maybe $75 to $150 or up. And then what's happening now is if you get the card after August 27th, then it will be good for 2 years. And so that essentially cuts the card cost in half, because before it was $150 a year.
Yeah. So lawmakers are doing this not necessarily to benefit cardholders, or are they? Is there some sort of, because I was even wondering if they just don't want as much money coming in from the program.
There has been a problem with too much money coming into the program. And whether or not certain, especially Republican legislators, want to help the program or not, I'm not going to say. I wasn't totally privy to all the sort of machinations of the way this legislation was put together. It was probably a compromise in some way to let this testing portion go through. But it does sort of solve the problem of having too much money come in. And this could be seen as a problem really no matter which side of the aisle you're on, because there's a fund that has been just piling up with money. It's got over $80 million in it, according to the 2020 budget, and it's not really being used for much. And so it's just an accumulation of money for no real purpose. And at the same time, patients are paying too much for their card for no real reason. So there's just, it's kind of a lose-lose. Republicans have been sort of wary about passing or trying to pass some legislation that would use that money, because the money would have to be used to benefit the program, and a lot of them aren't sure they want to do that.
This does not work in the same way that when we had the tobacco settlement, for example, that was going to be used for education or used for whatnot. It actually would have to be used to benefit that particular program. You couldn't redistribute the fund in some way.
You could if you passed a law that allowed that to happen.
Okay.
But because this is a Voter Protection Act law, you need a three-quarters majority. That can be tough to get. The $150 fee was implemented by Will Humble, the former director of DHS, and he's expressed some regrets about setting it that high. He wanted to make sure there was enough money to cover the maintenance and operation of the program, and there wouldn't be a cost to taxpayers. But he made the mistake, he admits, of misestimating how many people would be in the program. He thought maybe about 40,000 would be the limit, and unfortunately that was kind of wildly off, and it's about 200,000 now.
So what medical professionals are going to be most affected by this potentially?
Well, naturopaths are the type of physician that will be most affected by this, because they've been the most interested and sort of popular physician to go to get a medical marijuana card for various reasons. They've just emerged as the go-to physicians as opposed to osteopaths or allopaths, for example. And so their revenue, you could look at it and say it's going to be cut in half. That's not quite true, though. I was talking to a certification doctor, Dr. Elaine Burns, and she told me that about 50% of her patients each year are new, and only 50% are returning. So as she put it, she's going to take a 50% cut on 50%. But she's also optimistic, and I kind of share her optimism, that there may be a pretty big surge of people who have been sort of cut out from the higher cost and that are now going to join the program. So the ranks could expand. People like Dr. Burns could actually see more patients.
Let's talk about some of the testing of the product that's going to go in now. I spoke with a professor in Colorado who's been really studying what they've done when it comes to testing. How important do you think it is for Arizona to look at some of the other states and see what they've done as maybe a potential best practices sort of thing?
I think that they should study it closely, and I imagine that the advisory council people will study it closely. There's been a few problems in other states with testing. There's been what has been referred to as choke points, where all of a sudden there's been too few labs or too little testing going on, and the dispensaries aren't getting the amount of product they want, and customers aren't getting the product. So there's a real desire to avoid that here. And although, of course, we want to find out if the products have any kinds of bad things in them, a recall would be bad for the industry. Mm-hmm. It would be bad publicity, and it would also be pretty bad for the dispensary if that were publicized.
Great. Race Turner, Phoenix New Times. Good to see you. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
This is The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger here along with Steve Goldstein. Still to come on the show, I'll sit down with the Pistoleros as they are about to be inducted into the Arizona Music Hall of Fame. But first, we turn to Iran. The relationship between the U.S. and Iran has been strained over the past couple of weeks. Yesterday, Iran violated a key provision of the 2015 deal meant to curb its nuclear program. The country now owns more nuclear fuel than is allowed by the international agreement. This comes after last month's escalation in the region, with the U.S. saying it had sent 1,000 more troops to the Middle East. A couple of days later, Iran shot down a U.S. surveillance drone. In response, President Trump ordered a retaliatory strike against Iran, but called it off at the last minute. And that's to say nothing about the escalating rhetoric between leaders in the two countries. Our co-host Mark Brody spoke more about this with Daniel Rothenberg, co-director of the Center for the Future of War at ASU.
I know that there are a number of incidents and comments and other types of things that have led us to where we are now between the U.S. and Iran. Is there one thing we can point to as to why it is that tensions have ramped up to the point that they're at this point?
I guess it's an interesting question whether tensions are really ramped up. Obviously, the history of U.S. tensions with Iran goes back to the 1979 revolution and many things that happened subsequently. Clearly, there's a moment right now with elevated tensions, but, you know, it's a little over a year ago when Trump pulled out of the JCPOA and
the Iran nuclear deal.
The Iran nuclear deal, as it's called. Yeah. And so there's a lot of heated rhetoric. There have been a few incidents that could be serious incidents, but it's difficult to really know how much more elevated tensions are right now.
So you don't think necessarily things are worse between the U.S. and Iran now than they were, say, 6 months or a year ago?
It's difficult to say, and I'm not sure that that's the most important metric, because all it takes to seriously ramp up tensions in extremely dangerous ways is a single incident or an escalation based on some sort of perception of an incident.
So do you consider, for example, the shooting down of a drone or the president of the U.S. saying that he would consider obliterating parts of Iran? Like, is that one of those things that would maybe really ramp things up?
You never know. I mean, it wasn't that long ago when a number of U.S. Navy sailors were taken hostage by Iranian forces. That was a serious incident, although it passed without any great substantive tension beyond a kind of steady degree of animosity and complexity in the relations. But those are two different incidents. So shooting down a drone is serious in some ways. What it really means is an open question. Obviously, the language of the president is very significant, and yet we've spent the last several years hearing extremely serious claims made by the president of the United States that end up turning into bluster or not much. Look, think of North Korea.
From the Iranian perspective, how do you get the sense that they perceive what's going on over here, be it the rhetoric from the president, rhetoric from other politicians, reaction to, for example, a drone being shot down?
Maybe the biggest problem, I think, with the way Iran is talked about here in the United States is as if it's a unitary entity in which all members of the government and all members of society are somehow in lockstep around a particular narrative and understanding of the United States or anything else. Iran, like lots, like everywhere, is a complex place. And politically, it's quite divided among a number of different players, not all of whom are interested in the same sort of relationship with the United States. The Iran nuclear deal was complex for players within Iran to convince other players within Iran to proceed. So there's a lot going on, and I think that we would all be better served if we took a step back and conceptualized Iran as a place as complex, as internally divided as, let's say, our own country or even anywhere else.
Does that potentially affect the kind of response we might see from Iran, be it from the Supreme Leader or from other members of the government or from the Revolutionary Guard or just from regular citizens there?
Sure. There are multiple players with different interests. Their interests are in some cases competing, in some cases unified. Probably the thing that would unify Iranians most of all would be something like something extremely aggressive, like an attack, as you might imagine. But the hope, I think, for most folks out there in the U.S., in Iran, and elsewhere, is that we don't get overly wrapped up in heated rhetoric, but that we focus on concrete actions and plans and try to tone things down. Surely the worst outcome for just about everybody would be war.
You've mentioned the Iran nuclear deal a couple of times, and I'm wondering how significant you think the fact that the U.S. pulled out of that, how has that affected, how significant has that been in terms of affecting relations between the U.S. and Iran since that time, and maybe even Iran and the other number of countries that had signed on to it?
I think the most complex thing about pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal is how it signals the inability to respect agreements and negotiations with the state, with the United States. So the standard position of U.S. governments as one president comes in, another president leaves, and administrations shift, is that things that have been agreed upon, especially internationally, are respected not because everyone thinks those were the best deals, but because if one breaks all of them, it signals to the world that this may happen the next time around, and then why would you bother to take the political risks that are inherent in making a deal? So pulling out of the JCPOA, out of the Iran nuclear deal, is a devastating action in terms of U.S. credibility on the world stage.
Do you think that it makes it less likely that Iran would be willing to come to some kind of agreement with the U.S. to solve some other kind of problem?
Probably, but it's difficult to say because it probably depends what the deal is and what the specifics are. You know, there might be, again, some benefit to stepping away from the ideologically driven rhetoric about who's good and who's bad and towards kind of concrete goals and concrete things that could actually be negotiated. There have been periods of time when Iran and the U.S. have coordinated their activities quite substantially, for example, in the early stages of the Afghan war, the invasion of Afghanistan and early stages in the Afghan reconstruction. There was lots of productive activity, partly because there was an overlap and coordination of certain goals. And, you know, there's no reason why that isn't the case now. It may not be the best moment for these sorts of negotiations. It may, frankly, not be possible for any negotiations to take place without some measures that would encourage and enable greater trust, which probably would be a useful strategy.
All right. That's Daniel Rothenberg, co-director of the Center on the Future of War at ASU. Daniel, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So just how far down do you want to go? Well, we could talk it out over a cup of joe, and you could look deep into my eyes like I was a supermodel.
Okay, Steve, some Valley Music trivia for you. What song are we listening to right now?
Lauren, I actually know this one because I have this on vinyl, if you'll
you
believe
do.
This. Yes, Roger Klein's famous 96 hit Bandidos when he was with the Refreshments.
That's right. Klein is one of the local musicians who will be inducted into the Arizona Music and Entertainment Hall of Fame tonight at the Tempe Center for the Arts. Mike Myers is the acting president of the organization and says this year's ceremony will highlight the acts that made the 90s, quote, Tempe sound.
The nice thing about this group of people is the fact that they have Tempe roots. And although Roger Klein has pretty good visibility outside of Arizona, it's still homegrown bands that have had most of their success in their home area.
Myers says there was just something very special about that time. There was a feeling the Valley would be the next L.A. or Austin. The Pistoleros came up alongside Roger Klein's The Refreshments and the Gin Blossoms when the music scene on Mill Avenue exploded. Tonight, Roger Klein and the Peacemakers will be inducted alongside other Tempe acts, Dead Hot Workshop and the Pistoleros, as well as Long Wong's, one of the major venues on Mill Avenue at the time.
The show is sold out, which Myers attributes to the homegrown love for these acts.
All three of these groups have been very, very intentional about their music and their craft and very serious musicians and wanting to do this very badly and be successful at it. And I think that's why they've all succeeded, is because they're good artists, they're good craftspeople, they're intentional, they're personable, and they've just done a good job at sticking with their dream, if you will, and seeing it through.
The Pistoleros, Lawrence Zubia, and his brother Mark had been playing music together their whole lives, but they made it big as well in the late 90s with the release of their album, Hang On to Nothing, and the song, My Guardian Angel. I sat down with Zubia in our studios recently to talk more about their Hall of Fame induction and what it was like to ride that Tempe music wave in the late 90s.
Back in the 90s, it was full speed ahead. It was Mill Avenue, and it was really fun, and the energy was awesome almost every night of the week. There were so many places to play live music along Mill Avenue, and we could play live original music.
Yeah. So you founded the band with your brother and with some other folks I know in the
right.
music scene at the time. But it sounds like you two were incredibly close. Did you grow up writing music together?
You know, looking back now, because that's what this whole induction and this legacy thing has done. It's made me remember and think about a lot of the past. And yes, Mark and I, as teenagers, played guitar. I started writing songs immediately. The minute I could put three chords together, it just kind of happened because that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to write songs and sing them. Mark and I learned to play guitar from my dad, who was a musician. He was a mariachi musician with his brother. So it wasn't a huge leap to, you know, have guitars and be creating music in our house. We graduated from acoustic mariachi music into, our teenage years, finding out about people like Bob Dylan, Van Morrison, the Rolling Stones. And we started learning how to play those songs. And then that morphed into writing our own songs.
So when the band, you know, had that first kind of hit and like really kind of made it on a different level, what did that feel like? Like how satisfying, how exciting was it at the time?
It was awesome. I remember the first time I heard our song on the radio, we were going to do a show in Miami, and we got picked up at the airport. We usually got picked up in a, you know, like a van, like a 15-passenger van, church van type thing. But this time the guy came and he picked us up in this long stretch white limo. He must have known what was about to happen. So we were cruising out of the airport, down the highway, heading to Hard Rock Cafe to have lunch with a bunch of listeners that won tickets to have lunch with the Pistoleros.
Whoa.
It was like this whole surreal moment. And the song came on the radio.
And as I heard through the cold Nebraska night, I hear your voice and know that I might be all right.
It was like out of a movie, you know?
That is a movie scene right there.
It was crazy. Miami, white limo, song on the radio, and it was the greatest feeling in the world. I'm not going to lie. It was awesome.
So you had a long estrangement from your brother, though, and
we
from
did.
Music, it sounds like.
We did.
And you came back together in 2015. Can you tell us how that changed the relationship, how that changed the music?
Right. We actually had no contact with each other. Mm-hmm. And we got back together, and almost immediately we signed a record deal with Fervor Records. Fervor Records is based here in Sunny Slope. And Fervor let us do, gave us basically 100% artistic control over the record. We made the record we wanted. Fervor's main business model is licensing songs to television and film. Hmm. And that's the first time in our career that that has happened. Now we are, we're very happy.
Yeah,
it,
yeah.
It ends up, you know, validating a lot of things. You know, it was a paycheck. It was also just validating our songwriting over the years, and it felt like a little bit of a payoff after everything we put into this.
Yeah. She said, "Babe, can you try to make me scream? I saw
life walking in between." So my brother and I, our estrangement was one thing, but after we got back together, it really sparked a creative period, and we wrote a bunch of songs in the last couple of years.
Yeah, and you had another record out just a couple of years
yep.
ago in 2017.
Yep.
So let's talk about that creative boom you've been experiencing the last couple of years, writing all this music again with your brother. How's the music different?
In a lot of ways, the music is different. In a lot of ways, the recording techniques are different, which kind of changes the way, you know, you think about writing songs. It's changed a lot. What hasn't changed is the basic creative process of being inspired, getting inspired. When you're inspired, are you near a guitar when, you know, the sparks are going? Can you capture that inspiration and put it in a song? A lot of that hasn't changed, how you write a song.
You're one of those who, when you get the idea, you have to go write it right then?
Have to write it then, have to hit the voice thing on my phone. I've got literally hundreds of ideas like that in my phone. And then sometimes, and this is when it's at its most beautiful, is when you write a song and the entire song is written within like the length of the song in 4.5 minutes.
And it's
the
done.
Song is done.
You've written the whole thing.
Yep. And those are I think are the best songs.
They fall into your head, right?
Yeah.
I will meet you in the office of a lawyer, and we will watch the past implode like a voyeur.
So Arizona Music Hall of Fame. So this feels like a, like you mentioned, like a legacy moment, right?
It does.
So what do you think your legacy is? What do you hope your legacy is to Arizona music in particular?
Right. Well, it's hard to have perspective, but I look at it like these two native to Phoenix Chicano brothers kind of just made this unspoken bond, and it was through guitars and lyrics and melody, and we muscled our way into opening for the Blossoms and getting into that scene, and in a beautiful way, everyone accepted us and loved us, and we just wanted to contribute to that music scene. Mm-hmm. And we kind of, you know, by osmosis adopted this sound, I guess. It used to be called the Tempe sound, mm-hmm. and I totally rejected that idea that there was a sound and that, you know, it was, you know, native to Tempe. But I have turned around 180 degrees on that. Looking back through this Hall of Fame induction and looking back on the last 30 years and listening to a lot of songs, there is most definitely a Tempe sound.
You accept the Tempe sound now.
I have, and I can't believe I'm even saying that on radio and admitting it to the public. But there is, man. Yeah, we were right smack in the middle of it, for better or for worse.
But there's also a distinctly Arizona sound to you, because, like you say, like you can tell when you listen to your music that you grew up playing mariachi. There's the horns in there. You have Spanish in there. Like, there's something in there that feels very Arizona.
Definitely. You know, I'm not a really crafty songwriter. I don't think, I'm going to write a song that has some Spanish vibe in it or flamenco vibe in it or anything. It just happens, mm-hmm. you know? It's like you were kind of alluding to, it's just part of the DNA.
All right. Lauren Zubia with the Pistoleros, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.